Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Professional Responsibilities and Legal Education Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, October 18, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Please note that while this call originally provided CLE, the credit is no longer available.
Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. The main topic of today's call is the new ABA Model Rule 8.4G. This teleforum is also our 2018 Ethics CLE teleforum. My name is Michael Wallen, and I am the Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Professor Josh Blackman, who is an associate professor of law at the South Texas College of Law in Houston. Without further ado, Professor, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to talk to you all today. My format is I will give remarks for about 45 minutes, and then we'll have the last 15 minutes or so open for questions. Please, if you have questions, I'll put them down and we'll get to them later. Our topic today is ABA Model Rule Professional Conduct 8.4G. The American Bar Association approved it in August of 2016. It's roughly 2 years ago. Under this proposed rule, it is misconduct for an attorney to, quote, engage in conduct that the lawyer knows or reasonably should know is harassment or discrimination on the basis of race, sex, religion, national origin, ethnicity, disability, age, sexual orientation, gender identity, marital status, or socioeconomic status in conduct related to the practice of law. Conduct 4 to the rule explains that conduct related to the practice of law includes representing clients, interacting with witnesses, coworkers, court personnel, lawyers, and others while engaged in the practice of law, operating or managing a law firm or law practice, and here comes the important part, participating in bar association, business, or social activities in connection with the practice of law. The model rule is just that, a model that does not apply in any jurisdiction. Now the project goes to the states as state Supreme Courts consider whether to adopt Rule 8.4G. In 2017, I wrote an article on this topic in the Georgetown Journal of Legal Ethics, in which I urged states to pause for adopting Rule 8.4G in light of its First Amendment implications. And since then, I have filed a number of comments in state Supreme Courts urging states to reject adoption of this rule. So far, at least 9 states have rejected the rule. Arizona, Idaho, Illinois, Louisiana, Minnesota, Montana, Nevada, South Carolina, and Tennessee. The Texas Attorney General for my home state, Ken Paxton, went a step further. And he said that the Model Rule 8.4G is a violation of the First Amendment. A couple other states have reached similar conclusions. A few states still have open comment periods, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, and Utah, but they haven't made a decision yet. Based on my count, only one state adopted the rule, which is Vermont, and they did it really below the radar. They made a small notice of the proposed rule in the publication, which I didn't even see, and a lot of people follow this didn't see either. So to repeat, at the present moment, only one state, Vermont, has adopted the rule, but the process is still not over. And other states are concurrently considering the rule. My talk today has 3 parts. First, I want to focus on how Rule 8.4G extends a disciplinary committee's jurisdiction to, quote, conduct related to the practice of law, for speech that can be deemed, quote, harassment. Lectures given at CLE events or dinnertime conversation at a bar association function or perhaps even a firm Twitter account would now be subject to discipline if the speaker reasonably knows or should know that someone might find it derogatory. This threat of sanction, I think, will inevitably chill speech on matters of public concern. Neither the rule nor its comments express any awareness of this novel intrusion into private spheres of an attorney's professional life. Second, I will compare the operation of Rule 8.4G with previous model ABA rules, as well as state-adopted anti-bias regimes. Rule 8.4G is largely unprecedented, as it extends a disciplinary committee's jurisdiction to conduct merely related to the practice of law, with only the most tenuous connection to representation of clients, a lawyer's fitness, or the administration of justice. Third, I want to discuss Rule 8.4G's chilling effects. Though courts have generally upheld the regulation of attorney speech in the context of practice of law, so the third part of my talk focuses on the chilling effects of Model Rule 8.4G. Courts have generally upheld the regulation of attorney speech in the context of the practice of law, as the expression becomes more attenuated from the Bar Association's traditional purposes, the state interest becomes far less compelling. In this sense, past precedents upholding disciplinary actions for attorney speech are largely unhelpful. Rule 8.4G sweeps in vast amounts of speech on matters of public concern and imposes, I think, an unlawful form of viewpoint discrimination, primarily on conservative speech. At bottom, the defenders of this model rule can only urge us to trust the disciplinary committees. The First Amendment demands much more. So the first part of my talk looks at Rule 8.4G and how it was designed to eradicate verbal harassment. Now, let me say at the outset that the drafters of Rule 8.4G were well-intentioned. I think they were very well-intentioned.
They were trying to eradicate discrimination and harassment of the sexual nature in the legal profession.
I think that was a very well-intentioned function. Where I think they went awry was by not having enough safeguards to limit the scope of it. And I can give some evidence of this. In February 2016, there was a hearing held about the model rule. Several witnesses expressed their concerns about sexual harassment that occurs in the practice of law, and in particular, at after-hour social functions. For example, one New York lawyer said that no one wants to interrupt the private aspects of a lawyer's life. But she stressed that she was concerned that so much sexual harassment and bullying against women takes place on the way home from an event or in a limo traveling on the way back from a long day of litigation. She said that merely describing these as social events as opposed to professional events is not accurate. And she expressed concern that a lot of bad activity goes on at social events, and those misconduct should be punished by the bar. Another member of the ABA offered anecdotes of sexual harassment at a Christmas party, perhaps where a male partner asked a female associate to dinner after a deposition, followed by an invitation to come up to my room. And she asked rhetorically, is that in relation to the practice of law? She suggested that the rule should govern conduct that's more than simply related to the technical practice of law. And the ABA, I think, adopted this understanding. And they cited substantial anecdotal evidence provided to the committee of sexual harassment at activities such as law firm dinners and other nominally social events at which lawyers are present solely because of their association with their law firm. So read against this history, Rule 8.4G and Comment 4 were crafted to allow disciplinary boards to punish lawyers who engage in sexual harassment at social activities that are not strictly connected with the attorney-client relationship or the operation of a law practice. Again, I think these motivations are well-intentioned, but they went much further than that. They do more than punish sexual harassment, which is a very well-established body of law. As a threshold matter, the rule does not prohibit only sexual harassment, but it also extends to a far broader category of just harassment. Comment 3 defines harassment to include, quote, derogatory or demeaning verbal conduct. If we look at Black's Law Dictionary, the word demeaning means, quote, exhibiting less respect for a person or a group of people than they deserve, or causing them to feel embarrassed, ashamed, or scorned. If you look up derogatory in the Oxford Dictionary, it's defined as showing a critical or disrespectful attitude. If you have a code that prohibits speech that fits any of these definitions, disrespectful, critical, scorn, this is speech that's entirely protected by the First Amendment. It doesn't fit into any sort of categorical exceptions, such as fighting words or incitement. It's fairly well established in our legal system that there's no harassment exception to the First Amendment. There are some case laws suggesting that sexual harassment is treated differently, and I won't engage that here. But there's no general harassment exception to the First Amendment, and that's important. The courts have generally permitted the imposition of damages for verbal, that is, non-physical sexual harassment, in the employment context so long as the speech was, quote, severe or pervasive, that it creates a hostile or offensive work environment. This is a very high standard, and it can't be done, perhaps, on a single event, generally speaking. Comment 3 to the rule explains that the substantive law of anti-discrimination may guide application of Rule 8.4G, but it doesn't follow it exactly, and there's no requirement of severity or pervasiveness. A single harassing comment under this rule could result in attorney discipline. Further, the rule extends beyond the work environment. Rule 8.4G and Comment 4 provide a near infinite number of fora where speech can give rise to discipline. And I'll give a couple examples. For example, lectures and debates hosted by bar associations that offer continuing legal education credits are necessarily held in connection with the practice of law. Indeed, this very teleform I'm speaking to right now, I think, is in connection with the practice of law. You need the CLE credit to keep your license. So I think at this point, were I in a state with 8.4G, I would be subject to this rule. Lawyers are required to take these classes. I think they're mandatory. Now, it's not difficult to imagine how certain topics could reasonably be found by attendees to be derogatory or demeaning on the basis of one of the 11 protected classes in 8.4G. Consider 11 examples. I'll give you 11. So first, race. A speaker discusses mismatch theory and contends that race-based affirmative action should be banned because it hurts minority students by placing them in an education setting where they have a lower chance of success. This is a fairly robust discussion in the affirmative action debate, but this could be deemed derogatory, demeaning, and give rise to discipline. Second, consider gender. A speaker argues that women should be not eligible for combat duty in the military and should continue to be excluded from selective service requirements. Again, this is a matter of public concern in which people disagree, but this could be derogatory on the basis of gender. Three, let's consider religion. A speaker states that the owners of a for-profit corporation who request religious exemption from the contraceptive mandate are bigoted and misogynistic. This actually goes the other way. It's the religious business owner who might feel demeaned by these sort of comments. Fourth, national origin. A speaker contends the plenary power doctrine in immigration law permits the government to exclude aliens from certain countries that are deemed dangerous. This could be deemed demeaning to people of certain nationalities. Again, a matter of public concern that the Supreme Court passed on only a few months ago. So far I've given 4 examples of race, gender, religion, and national origin where certain statements made could be offensive and demeaning, where that could give rise to discipline. I'll give a couple more. Fifth, we have ethnicity. For example, a speaker states that Korematsu was correctly decided and that during times of war, the president should be able to exclude individuals based on their ethnicity. Again, controversial, meaning for sure. Sixth, disability. A speaker explains that people with mental handicaps should be eligible for the death penalty. Seven, age. A speaker argues that minors convicted of murder can constitutionally be sentenced to life without parole. Eight, sexual orientation. A speaker contends that a Burgerfeld v. Hodges, the same-sex marriage case, was incorrectly decided, and that the 14th Amendment does not prohibit classifications on the basis of sexual orientation. A Burgerfeld 5-4 case in which the country was fairly divided, this would be a topic that many people might find demeaning. Even say it might give rise to disciplinary action. Ninth, you have gender identity. A speaker states that Title IX cannot be read to prohibit discrimination on the basis of gender identity, and that students should be assigned to bathrooms based on their biological sex. Gender identity is one of the prohibited classes. 10, marital status. A speaker remarks over dinner that unmarried attorneys are better candidates for law firms because they'll be able to dedicate more time to the practice. I'm sure people have heard this sort of message quite a lot, That cannot give rise to a disciplinary action. 11th is the oddest of the bunch, which is socioeconomic status, basically how much money a person has. A speaker posits that low-income individuals who receive public assistance should be subject to mandatory drug testing. Now, all these statements were chosen, all 11, to be provocative, and I made them quite provocative on purpose. The reason why I made them provocative on purpose is that the speaker, quote, reasonably should know that someone at the event could find the remarks disparaging towards one of these 11 groups. For example, a person whose marriage was legalized by Obergefell, or who gained access to the bathroom of choice under an interpretation of Title IX, or who immigrated from a country subject to a travel ban, or who was admitted to college under an affirmative action plan, could plausibly feel demeaned by such argument. Lest you think that these charges are implausible, consider the reaction to Justice Scalia's discussion of mismatch theory during oral argument in Fisher versus University of Texas at Austin. A CLE lecture on any of the 11 topics would be entirely protected by the First Amendment, yet could still give rise to liability under Rule 8.4G. And this is not just an instance where CLE lectures are covered. If a firm has a social media presence on Twitter, if a lawyer has perhaps a Facebook account which uses partially for business, maybe for not, his even posts online could be roped into this. These 11 examples should reveal another fairly obvious result. Speech on the right side of the political spectrum would disproportionately give rise to liability. I can't make this point too bluntly. There is a viewpoint discrimination, and I'll come back to this later in my talk. Comment 4 provides an even greater number of fora that could be deemed connected to the practice of law. For example, a dinner hosted by a bar association, or perhaps by the Federal Society, or the NAACP, are social activities with a connection to the practice of law. If any of these 11 topics were discussed at the dinner table at such events, an attendee who felt demeaned could file a bar complaint. Yes, a bar complaint against you for dinner table conversations of this nature. Additionally, in my profession, law professor, I think my lectures are related to the practice of law. If a student feels demeaned by one of my lectures, rather than going to the associate dean to complain, they can go to the state bar and file a complaint against me. I don't think such a complaint would be prosecuted, but this is something that professors should be quite aware of in any jurisdiction that adopts this rule. I think this rule could even apply to an attorney speaking at career day at his child's Catholic school about the role of faith in the practice of law. Now, whether or not these complaints lead to any disciplinary action, there's a threat of liability that chills speech at a CLE debate, a dinner, or in the classroom. Now, this wasn't hard to figure out, right? These problems were obvious. But the most striking aspect of the adoption of Rule 8.4G is how little awareness the ABA expressed about the boundless scope of prohibited speech. Neither the rule nor the comment even referenced the First Amendment. Now, charitably, maybe these concerns were not on the minds of the drafters as they focus on substantial anecdotal information about sexual harassment. But there's reason to suspect there was an effort to prohibit this sort of speech. An earlier draft of Comment 3 from December 2015 said, quote, "The rule does not apply to conduct unrelated to the practice of law or conduct protected by the First Amendment." And there was a report that said, "A lawyer retains a private sphere where personal opinion, freedom of information, religious expression, and political speech is protected by the First Amendment and not subject to the rule." This was great language. I liked it, but they cut it. They actually deleted from the rule the only reference to the First Amendment, and I can only think this change was deliberate. In fact, several members of the committee who drafted the rule said that this might make it too hard to prosecute misconduct, and that carving out exceptions would make it more difficult to go after harassment. So I think that the ABA was comfortable making this rule broader than it had to be. But a consequence of this is now we have this regrettable omission, where we have this proposed rule that I think limits a wide range of attorney speech, and the rule makes no reference to why free speech ought to be protected. Now I'll move on to the second part of my talk. The scope of Rule 8.4G is large and unprecedented. in how far it goes beyond regulating conduct related to the practice of law, conduct related to a lawyer's fitness for practice, or conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice. This second part of my talk will analyze how Model Rules 8.4 A through F, which were old, operated before the amendment, and discuss how states have narrowly tailored their anti-bias disciplinary provisions. The point I'd like to convey in the second part is states can regulate bias and improper conduct in the legal profession, but do so in a more narrowly tailored fashion that doesn't raise the First Amendment problems that does 8.4G. So the first seven sections of the Model Rules of Professional Conduct govern the responsibilities, duties, and restrictions on attorneys when they're practicing law or representing clients. If you have your model rules handy, you can flip through them along with me. Rules 1.0 through 1.18 define the various attributes of the client-lawyer relationship, including conflicts of interest and duties owed to clients. Rules 2.1 through 2.4 discuss the attorney's role as a counselor. Rules 3.1 through 3.9 prescribe an attorney's responsibilities as an advocate before tribunals and other forums. Rules 4.1 through 4.4 establish how an attorney must transact with people other than clients. Rules 5.1 through 5.7 govern an attorney's responsibilities as part of a law firm or association. Rules 6.1 through 6.5 center around an attorney's commitment to public service, including pro bono work. Rules 7.1 through 7.6 focus on how an attorney can convey information about legal services, such as through advertising to and solicitation of clients. If an attorney violates any of these rules, he or she is in violation of Rule 8.4A. Now, the remainder of Rule 8.4 governs conduct that is increasingly more attenuated than the actual practice of law. For example, Rule 8.4B states that it is misconduct to, quote, commit a criminal act that reflects adversely on the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer in other respects. Not all criminal acts are misconduct, only those that reflect adversely on the lawyer's honesty, trustworthiness, or fitness as a lawyer in other respects. In a sense, white-collar crimes, more so than violent crimes, warrant this disapprobation. Rule 8.4C provides that it is misconduct to engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. Thus, even if an action is not criminal, so long as it involves dishonesty, it warrants disciplinary action. So far, so good. Indeed, I think Rule 8.4C swallows up virtually all the conduct that satisfies 8.4B and then some. These two provisions articulate a standard that a lawyer's actions, even when unconnected with the practice of law, must at all times promote honesty and trustworthiness, so there's no doubt about his or her fitness to practice law. Well, 8.4D states that lawyers cannot engage in conduct that is prejudicial to the administration of justice. Perhaps the most famous example of this rule involves President Clinton. Former President Clinton was suspended from the practice of law because he gave knowingly evasive and misleading discovery responses concerning his relationship with Ms. Lewinsky. This conduct, the court found, was prejudicial to the administration of justice. Even though Mr. Clinton was not engaged in the practice of law, he was still bound by this rule. He also lied under oath, which violated, I think, Rule 8.4C. Rule 8.4E prohibits lawyers from stating or implying an ability to influence a government official or agency. We have 8.4F, which prohibits knowingly assisting a judge or a judicial officer in a violation of the applicable rules. Okay, so far so good. All of the bar's rules have a pretty good connection with legal practice or court or something with the administration of justice. I say they fall into three heads of conduct. First, conduct during the practice of law or representing a client. Second, conduct that reflects on a lawyer's fitness to practice law. And third, conduct prejudicing the administration of justice. Model Rule 8.4G is different. It covers conduct that's just related to the practice of law, including speech at bar associations and social activities. This rule represents an unprecedented expansion of the disciplinary committee's jurisdiction over the private lives and speech of attorneys. And this was known to the people who were drafting the rule, right? They recognized, if you look through their proceedings, okay? Even the ABA acknowledged that Rule 8.4G is broader than the current provision, but they insisted that this change is necessary. The ABA's resolution said, quote, ethics rules should make clear that the profession will not tolerate harassment and discrimination in any conduct related to the practice of law. Beyond serving as officers of the courts, the ABA said, lawyers are, quote, public citizens with a special responsibility for the administration of justice. You're public citizens. This notion of an attorney as a public citizen is derived from Preamble 6 of the Model Rules, right? Critically, the preamble discusses an attorney's interactions as very private with clients and the like. It's not designed to make all aspects of an attorney's life governed by the bar. And what the model rule does is shift toward that norm. I think it's an important goal to make sure that all attorneys behave in a dignified fashion at all times, but the bar only has a certain jurisdiction. And in addition to the constitutional concerns, I think it goes too far. Now, we have, in nearly 36 jurisdictions, anti-bias provisions. And I think most of these are narrowly tailored enough to survive constitutional scrutiny. Why? With a few exceptions, these rules only govern conduct within the three heads of conduct reached by Rule 8.4A through F, right? You have rules that prohibit bias during the representation of a client or in the practice of law. This rule exists in 15 states and 10 states under comment. Second, you have a far broader standard that regulates bias that implicates a lawyer's fitness to practice law. This has only two states have adopted this. And third, a handful of states have adopted a nebulous standard that prohibits bias that would prejudice the administration of justice. Now, that's perhaps the most nebulous one, but all of them have a fairly close connection with the practice of law. Rule 8.4G goes much beyond it. It's only conduct related to the practice of law. Now I want to turn to the third part of my presentation, which focuses on 8.4G and the First Amendment. When the ABA released their report, they gave the most cursory free speech analysis. Indeed, as I mentioned earlier, they deleted any reference to the First Amendment in the comments to the rule, which I think was a mistake. So the third part of my talk will analyze this vague standard's chilling effects on speech, how the rule sweeps in a range of constitutionally protected speech, and how the comments establish what I think is an invalid form of viewpoint discrimination. We start our analysis with constitutional scrutiny. And we know that with constitutional scrutiny, you have to balance the means and the ends. As the government's interest becomes more compelling, the rules tailoring need not be as narrow. Conversely, when the government's interest becomes less compelling, narrow tailoring becomes essential. Governing professional conduct is a compelling interest within a bar association's core jurisdiction. But here, the government's authority is at its apex, and narrow tailoring is not as critical. However, when you have conduct that's merely related to the practice of law, which includes speech at social events, the government's interest becomes far less compelling as it is outside the traditional regulatory function of bar association. In other words, when the nexus between the legal practice and the speech at issue becomes more attenuated, the disciplinary committee's authority to regulate an attorney's expression becomes weaker. As a result, narrow tailoring becomes critical to salvage the sanction's constitutionality. Stated differently, the same capacious standard of harassment could constitutionally support a punishment for an incident at a deposition, but not during a bar association dinner or CLE lecture. Context matters for the First Amendment. Because no jurisdiction has ever attempted to enforce a speech code over social activities merely connected with the practice of law, there are no precedents to turn to in order to assess such regimes' constitutionality. While discrimination and sexual harassment do have established bias of case law that can be referred to, long-standing ethic rules do not penalize harassment by itself in the context of private speech as social functions. In such fora, the government's interest is at its nadir, and tailoring must be extremely narrow to survive judicial scrutiny. Even before Rule 8.4G was adopted, attorneys often found themselves in the midst of that recurring inquiry into when lawyer conduct has a sufficient nexus with fitness to practice law that it ought to be a basis for lawyer discipline, even when it is marginal to the direct representation of the client. Now, discipline can be imposed for conduct merely related to the practice of law and totally unrelated to the direct representation of any clients. It is against this backdrop that the chilling effects of Rule 8.4G must be assessed. As drafted, the rule could discipline a wide range of speech on matters of public concern at events with only the most dubious connection with the practice of law. Though these laws may survive a facial challenge, they are quite vulnerable to individual challenges. If a jurisdiction adopts Rule 8.4G, some unlucky attorney can become a test case with his or her livelihood on the line. This is not a mere academic exercise. States must be very careful about adopting this novel new approach to discipline, the mandate of censoring speech on matters of public concern, only to those actions reversed by the courts. Let's start with the broad sweep of Rule 8.4G. Again, the comments provide several examples of the various fora where the regime would apply. It mentions social activities, bar association functions. However, the long deliberated rule does not offer examples of the type of speech that can be deemed harassment. What is harassment? I would say that the bar lacks a sufficiently compelling interest to censor an attorney who makes a remark deemed demeaning at a CLE lecture, or makes a comment deemed derogatory at a dinner table, right? These are the sorts of problems that can be resolved by refusing to re-invite offending speakers, social cues, not by threatening to suspend or revoke a lawyer's license. Here, the nexus between the bar's mission to regulate the practice of law is far too attenuated to justify this incursion into constitutionally protected speech. A private sphere must remain in a lawyer's life when it is separate from the practice of law or representing a client and does not reflect on a lawyer's fitness or prejudice the administration of justice. Finally, there's a separation of powers element of this analysis. It's not surprising that disciplinary actions fall into these three narrow heads. Why? State bar associations are charged to supervise the legal profession. Disciplinary committees do not have boundless discretion over all aspects of an attorney's life. Like all administrative agencies, bar associations only have the authority that the relevant state legislature or court delegates to them. Right? When a bar attempts to regulate conduct that is beyond its jurisdiction, its action is ultra vires as a matter of state administrative law. So beyond the First Amendment implications of Rule 8.4G, state courts should consider whether bar associations even have the statutory authority to assert jurisdiction over speech that is increasingly attenuated from the practice of law. As a matter of separation of powers under state constitutional law, I think Rule 8.4G may be impermissible. Next, I want to talk about viewpoint discrimination. Under the First Amendment, the government can't pick winners and losers in a debate. It can't choose one viewpoint over the other. That is unconstitutional. Comment 4 to Rule 8.4G says, quote, lawyers may engage in conduct undertaken to promote diversity and inclusion. Again, they can take conduct to promote diversity and inclusion without violating the rules, for example, by implementing initiatives aimed at recruiting, hiring, and retaining and advancing diverse employees. This was a provision that was well intended, but it explicitly sanctions one perspective on divisive issue, affirmative action. Those who endorse affirmative action are excused from misconduct. Those who take the opposite perspective can be punished. This is viewpoint discrimination, and blatantly so. Consider a debate hosted by Bar Association about affirmative action. One speaker promotes racial preferences as a means to advance diversity, his speech is entirely protected under Rule 8.4G. Another speaker critiques racial preferences in light of mismatch theory, his speech is not protected under 8.4G. This is a blatant instance of preferring one perspective over another. Again, that the ABA sought to include provisions suggests there was concern that bar complaints could be filed over speech by affirmative action or the diversity measures that some could find demeaning, but not for other types of speech. Beyond speech by diversity, Rule 8.4G will disproportionately affect speech on the right side of the spectrum, if you're very blatant about this. Speech supporting a right to same-sex marriage will not be considered derogatory. Speech critiquing it will. Speech supporting an interpretation of Title IX that permits bathroom assignments based on gender identity will not be considered demeaning. Speech critiquing it will. Speech opposing immigration policy that excludes people based on nationality will not be considered discriminatory. Speech endorsing it will. A range of theories could be silenced under the threat of an unconstitutionally vague standard of harassment. Experiences with political correctness and speech codes on college campuses provide a roadmap for the sorts of speech that complaints filed under Rule 8.4G would likely target. Very recently, we saw students at Harvard University filing Title IX complaints against Judge Kavanaugh, and they claimed that there wasn't really much of a basis for it, but they're going to do it anyway. We can see the thing with bar complaints, and if you think that these won't be abused, pay attention to what's going on. There was a recent decision of the Supreme Court that I think throws even greater doubt onto 8.4G's constitutionality. The case was decided about 4 or 5 months ago called National Institute of Family and Life Advocates versus Becerra, a case from California. NIFLA, as the case is called, considered whether California could require certain medical facilities to display messages concerning the availability of public funding for abortions. In recent years, several circuit courts of appeals have strictly regulated speech associated with the legal profession, that is professional speech, when it involves personalized services and requires a professional license from the state. But the Supreme Court, in an opinion by Justice Thomas, took a different perspective. This sort of regime gives the states, quote, unfettered power to reduce a group's First Amendment rights by simply imposing a licensing requirement. The court expressed caution with applying laxer scrutiny to so-called professional speech, as that standard would cover a wide array of individuals. And Justice Thomas mentioned doctors, lawyers, nurses, physical therapists, truck drivers, bartenders, barbers, and many others. Again, he stressed lawyers. Justice Thomas wrote that the government lacks unfettered power to regulate the speech of lawyers simply because they provide personalized services after receiving a professional license. The court identified two narrow exceptions to this rule, neither of which turned in the fact that professionals were speaking. In the first circumstance, the court has applied more deferential review to some laws that require professionals to disclose factual, non-controversial information in their commercial speech. This is the Zotero case from 1985. Now, this first condition is not relevant to 8.4G. Speech uttered in conduct related to the practice of law does not require professionals to disclose factual, non-controversial information. Second, Justice Thomas noted that states may regulate professional conduct, even if that conduct incidentally involves speech. This standard is directly relevant to 8.4G. The state can regulate professional conduct that incidentally involves speech, but it cannot regulate speech that incidentally involves professional conduct. The proposed amendment, by its own term, straddles that line. It applies to both conduct in the practice of law and words in the practice of law, right? This is not a merely incidental regulation. This is the entire kit and caboodle. Given that Rule 8.4G is subject to strict scrutiny, members of the bar will be faced with a notoriously vague standard. Specifically, what is conduct related to the practice of law? Relying on a case-by-case regime is a very sort of ad hoc standard that cannot meet strict scrutiny under the First Amendment. In light of NIFLA, a content-based restriction applied to conduct related to the practice of law cannot satisfy strict scrutiny. Now, let me end where perhaps should have began. In 2016, at the National Lawyers Convention in D.C., there was a debate on this rule. Professor Eugene Volokh of UCLA debated Professor Deborah Rohde from Stanford, and Judge Elrod from Fifth Circuit moderated that debate. Eugene and I largely agree on 8.4G. And Professor Volokh worried that you can have complaints filed against a speaker who criticizes the Obergefell decision because it might be demeaning people on the basis of sexual orientation. Professor Rohde wasn't concerned with this potential for abuse. From her experiences, she said disciplinary committees don't have resources to go after people who steal from their clients' trust fund accounts. She found wildly out of touch with reality the notion that they are going to start policing social conferences and go after people who make claims about their own views about religion or sexual orientation. Rohde added that many people who are in the bar disciplinary agencies care a lot about First Amendment values, and bar associations don't want to set up their members and go down these routes. She said an aggrieved party can file a complaint, but we can say that just about anything in this country, right? She said complaints will go nowhere. She added, we as a profession have the capacity to deal with occasional abuses. She concluded her remarks, we're a profession that knows better than that, I would hope. A couple minutes later, Judge Elrod asked whether Professor Rohde's position would depend on a trust that the organization would not be going after people that they don't like, such as conservatives. She asked, we would just have to trust them. You know, if you were there, almost everyone started laughing in the room when Professor Rohde said we have to trust them. I don't think a lot of people trust the bars to administer these sorts of rules in a neutral fashion. And whether or not we trust them, the First Amendment demands much, much more than that. Principles of free speech and the liability of attorneys should not be left to the discretion of bar disciplinary committees. In its current form, Rule 8.4G should not be adopted. And again, at least 9 states have rejected the rule to date. Arizona, Idaho, Illinois, Louisiana, Minnesota, Montana, Nevada, South Carolina, and Tennessee. Again, the Texas Attorney General, Ken Paxton, put out an opinion saying it's unconstitutional. Only Vermont has adopted it. California adopted a rule that's somewhat similar, but I think quite different in a number of regards. Indeed, it actually began before 8.4G came around, so I don't consider it an adoption of 8.4G. But no state except for Vermont has actually gone forward. But this process is ongoing, and maybe your state is considering it. If it is, I would consider telling you to write a letter to the bar or to the state Supreme Court or wherever the agency is, raising some of the concerns that I flagged here. If you do that and the people in your state courts recognize their problems, then maybe they won't adopt it. Maybe they can adopt a more narrowly tailored bias provision that can go after problems but not censor speech. In the end, I think state courts should pause before adopting this rule and think carefully about the primacy of our first freedom. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Professor. We will now go to our first question.
Okay, this is Dennis Kirk in Washington, D.C. Professor, do they really think that freedom of speech can be so easily regulated that the ABA, who's gone terribly one-sided in politics, should be trusted with it?
You know, thank you for the question. If you read through the proceedings of these deliberations, there were some lawyers in the ABA who did raise free speech concerns, but these concerns are largely dismissed. My sense is that the ABA is more concerned with rooting out harassment, discrimination, and if that incidentally makes some people not say certain things, I don't think they mind very much. But again, with the First Amendment, it's not the role of the individual to put the justification why he gets engaged in the speech. It's the burden on the government to why they have to censor it, and I don't think they've had nearly enough of a compelling interest to censor it, so which is why so far almost every state considered has so far rejected the rule.
Thank you, sir.
And let's go to our next question.
Professor Dennis Safran from New York. Has there been a challenge in Vermont, and do you happen to know the status of the rule in New York?
Thank you. I don't know that there's actually been any discipline brought against the rule in Vermont. The rule would probably survive a facial challenge. So I don't
right.
think it's a good idea.
Yeah.
I think the rule on its face is probably broad enough, but you'd have to bring an as-applied challenge.
Yep.
And I don't know that there's actually been any enforcement actions. As far as I know, New York has not adopted the rule. I don't know the status, but I'll look into that later.
All righty. Next caller.
I thought you did a good job of focusing on cases where there's no connection between the attorney's conduct or speech and his practice of law. I'm interested in your views on issues that perhaps would be more directly related to the practice of law. For example, if a client came to a lawyer and said, I am gay, I'd like you to represent me. And the lawyer said, well, I'm happy to represent you on all issues except for ones where you are pushing for increased gay marriage rights, because I, for religious reasons, don't handle those types of cases. Would that sort of refusal to take on cases be actionable either on this rule or perhaps some other existing rule?
Well, my understanding of the 8.4G, and I can check the comments in a minute, is it doesn't apply to the decision to accept a client. I think they still have an exception that with respect to taking on a client that you're not bound by this. So I think you can still have decisions that decline representation. And to answer the question from a moment ago, as far as I can tell from the CLS sheet, New York has not adopted 8.4G. They have a pre-existing analog, and they're studying at the moment. So I don't know that they haven't adopted it yet, but they're still studying the rule.
Okay, we'll go now to the next caller.
This is Brooks Harlow out in Tyson's Corner, but I'm a member of Washington and Oregon bars, which I think will look very kindly on this proposed rule. It occurs to me that a state bar that attempts to enforce this rule arguably is committing a 1983 violation, a deprivation of rights or property under color of state law, and that is something that I'm not sure you ever want to bring that lawsuit, but the threat of that might help discourage liberal-leaning bars from adopting or enforcing such a rule because it could cost them.
We have to recall that when the state brings a disciplinary action, it is a state actor. And I do think that they would be liable not only to challenge the enforcement action, but also to bring a collateral 1983 action, saying that the entire rule is problematic. I think we will – if any state brings this, you will see a lot of litigation. This is why I think states are turning it away. Thank you so much for the question.
And we have some more questions lined up.
This is Warren Belmar in Palm Beach, Florida. I think you made an unbelievably wonderful presentation and summary of the issues, and I hope that your speech is going to be reduced to writing and published either in a Federalist Society publication or a law review. The chilling effect that this rule has in speech has not really been appreciated by too many members of the bar. And you mentioned a number of examples where people not realizing they might be subject to the rule might find themselves being reported by others and subjected to a proceeding that they may win, but nevertheless suffer the problems that would flow from that during the pendency of a proceeding that subsequently gets dismissed. Question, judges are lawyers too. If a judge is participating in a CLE panel next to an attorney and they both say the same thing, and someone in the audience finds it offensive for whatever reason, any one of your 11 examples, would the individual be able to report to the Bar Association the misconduct of a federal or state judge?
So first off, the speech I gave today is based on an article I wrote in the Georgetown Journal of Legal Ethics, and it was published last year, and I'm sure the Federal Society can send a link out to the people who attended. You can download that and read it. All the footnotes are there. All the sources are there.
Well, I hope they can circulate the citation to it so we can all find it.
I'll give it the citation with the next question. But the second part of the question, judges are already subject to a fairly stringent speech code. And there's a robust body of case law on regulations and on judges' speech. It often comes up with campaign finance, with Republican Party Minnesota versus White case. So judges' speech is already restricted in far more contexts. They can't make political statements and the like, depending on the state. But what this rule is actually trying to do, 8.4, is bring attorneys in a similar space as judges, right? And actually, I spoke to a group of judges in Pennsylvania about this rule. And a couple of judges said, what's the big deal? Judges are already subject to this rule. Why can't other lawyers be subject to it? And my response is lawyers have an obligation to speak their consciences. They're not supposed to be neutral. They have a position. They have an opinion. But among a lot of the people within the ABA, they think, well, all lawyers should be these public citizens. They should be members of the bar through and through. I think that's a mistake. Again, if someone does try and bring this challenge, I think they will prevail. And it'll be maybe in a Supreme Court case as well.
We'll now go to the next question.
Good afternoon. This is Charlie Kaplan from New York. This presentation hits pretty close to home. I represent management in employment and labor law, and a number of years ago in a deposition, I asked a plaintiff in an employment discrimination case whether he had a criminal record. And the plaintiff's counsel objected strenuously, saying that my question was racist and I wouldn't have asked it if the plaintiff weren't an Hispanic. And I was wondering what your thought would be as to the application of this kind of a rule to that, or in general, particularly in the area of employment discrimination or Title IX, where those of us who are representing employers or representing others who are taking a position, say, against someone falsely claiming employment discrimination, just by advocacy, you know, I could see how our arguments are viewed as somehow being discriminatory.
Yeah, thank you for the question. I think the key word is, if your conduct is viewed as demeaning, right, in some sort of legal proceeding, that by itself could give rise to disciplinary action. Now, most states already have anti-bias provisions in the practice of law. I think taking a deposition would probably be within the practice of law. I think we'd all agree on that much. But what's different is that they generally require some form of severe pervasive harassment, not a one-off statement that could be demeaning. And that's why I think 8.4G takes an additional step toward not only restricting an attorney's speech, but perhaps even restricting their ability to advocate and be an effective attorney. The comments sort of poo-poo that, but your question, I think, gives rise to a case where you may want to ask a question that could be demeaning, and instead of getting, you know, a deposition testimony, you get a bar complaint filed.
Thank you.
Let's go to the next question.
Hello, this is Josh Montanini in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. Thank you very much for your talk. I was wondering if you could explain a little more your belief that this was well-intentioned versus something that was more pretextual, given that the way that the rule is drafted seems to be so broad, and what was described as the well intentions or the good intentions was just a few isolated kind of instances. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Maybe I'm much of an optimist. I'm on the sunny side of the mountain, as Justice Kavanaugh would say. But I generally assume people act in good faith. And I think there were documents or instances where particularly female associates at various firms were getting harassed sexually and subjected to, I think, improper conduct. So that's where I say that there is well intention here. The problem is that they were concerned that if they wrote the rule in a narrowly tailored fashion, perhaps an offhand sexist joke could perhaps escape it. Like, oh, I was just joking at dinner. It wasn't meant to be harassing. So they wrote this rule in a broad way to police what they viewed as conduct that simply should not happen, an offhand joke, maybe a sexual nature. But the problem is they made it so broad that it sweeps in a lot of speech that ought to be protected. And, you know, I've debated this topic a couple times in various law schools, and invariably the answer is trust us. You know, trust the bar. They're not going to enforce this in a fashion to go after protected speech. I'm not on the sunny side of the mountain. I'm very skeptical that they will enforce this in an even-handed manner. I think it will disproportionately fall on conservative speech by the very nature of the types of viewpoints they prefer.
And before we go to our next question, I just wanted to point out for the audience, I believe it was pointed out by a caller a few callers ago, that we do have in the Dropbox for the CLE materials, we have Professor Blackman's article titled Reply, A Pause for State Courts Considering Model Rule 8.4G. So if you're interested in seeing the full article, it is located there. We do have another question lined up, so we will proceed onward.
Yes, this is Jonathan Zimmer in Washington, D.C. I'm looking at Professor Blackman's article in the Georgetown Journal of Legal Ethics. It seems like the original motivation for this rule was, you know, it was driven by Me Too style considerations. You know, this was associates being harassed and subject to unwanted sexual advances, unwanted sexual conduct, and with all the things that have come out in Hollywood, Harvey Weinstein, Kevin Spacey, etc. Do you think that if they were trying to go for a more targeted rule to deal with this sort of harassment, why do you think they wrote this rule that it would be so broad? I mean, this is like trying to kill a mosquito with a shotgun.
I think if they had written a rule that only targeted sexual harassment on basis of gender, other groups would have felt perhaps left out. You know, what about racial harassment? What about gender identity, sexual orientation? Go down the list. So the 11 protected classes, I think they were designed to cover all the possible bases of groups that are subject to harassment. So I don't think they could have written a narrowly tailored rule going only after the sort of Me Too problems that we've happened in the last year really come to the fore. But yeah, the rule is not nearly narrowly tailored for the sort of problem that they identified, and I think they could have drafted something. Specifically, we have a body of case law for sexual harassment. And one of the important factors is it has to be both severe or pervasive, severe or pervasive, right? And has to create a hostile or offensive working environment. And those are standards put in place, I think, to deal with possible constitutional doubts. But this rule recognized none of those limitations. It was broadly applied. Even a single one-off comment at a bar association dinner table could now give a lot rise to not just perhaps social scorn, but also bar complaints.
We'll move on with the next question.
Good afternoon. This is Ned Jacobs from St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. How likely is it that there will be a court challenge in one of the states that has adopted the ABA model rule that would end up either before a state Supreme Court or perhaps even a federal court to try to strike down the rule?
Thank you for the question. Again, I think I mentioned earlier, a facial challenge is unlikely. You have to prove it unconstitutional in all regards. So probably you'd have an as-applied challenge. And I think you will have an as-applied challenge sooner or later. In terms of the U.S. Supreme Court, these sort of as-applied challenges are not very good vehicles. I don't know if it can be a circus split. So I think a SCOTUS case might not be in the works for a while. But you should pay a very close attention to Justice Thomas's decision in the NIFLA case, where he mentioned lawyers. And I was actually in the court last June when Justice Thomas announced his NIFLA opinion. And I was just sitting there listening, and when he said lawyers, I'm like, lawyers? 8.4G, I just almost stood up in my chair. So I'm sure that Justice Thomas is aware of this. Everything's on his radar, and the justices are indeed thinking about it.
And I believe we have one more question lined up in the queue, so we'll proceed to that.
What did you think about Justice Kavanaugh's testimony in the hearing that he said that he had ruled that a single instance of the N-word constituted a discriminatory workplace environment?
Is that the case he had ruled on? I didn't watch the entire testimony, so I'm not sure what you're referring to.
He said that even one instance of the N-word was constituted, I think, a racially discriminatory workplace environment.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I don't like opining on cases I haven't really studied, but I do appreciate the question. So thank you very much.
All righty. Well, that is all the questions we have lined up. Oh, one more came through. We'll make this one the very last one.
Yes, hello. I enjoyed the presentation. I wonder if you could expand on the idea that this is not content neutral. For any example you give, it seems to me you could turn it around and say, well, it could be painted by a person subjectively as discriminatory or, you know, or harassing. So, you know, for example, your mismatch. example of affirmative action. Someone could say, defending affirmative action is demeaning to me because it suggests that people who look like me cannot compete, do not have the intellectual acumen to be here, and need affirmative action. I'm wondering whether or not that could constitute a content-neutral defense, or if not, why not, and what lies behind the idea that there's a strong argument this is not content-neutral, or maybe to put it differently, not unbiased between a pro and anti position on any given policy dispute.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Whenever you have a statute that defines speech as harassment or demeaning or any sort of word like this, it's an implicit value judgment where some speech is harassing and some speech is not. That can be, I think, easily classified as viewpoint discrimination, as I noted earlier, but I think you'd also pigeonhole it into perhaps a content-based restriction, because speech that is harassing is permissible, and speech that's not harassing isn't. You're categorizing speech. And I think under a content-based approach, you have strict scrutiny applied. If you want to read Eugene Volokh's work on how workplace harassment laws are or perhaps are not constitutional, I think you should give it a careful read. But I think what saves those laws from any obvious facial challenge is requirements of severe or pervasive and creating an offensive work environment. It's got to be something ongoing that's not just the speech. It's speech plus. And this rule applies to speech and speech alone. I think that's why you have a very difficult time of upholding this regime.
And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert for the benefit of his time and expertise today. And thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.